Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
This is the way the league is. It's just going to be tight games that are tough. It just depends on, you know, the team that makes plays at the end. And obviously, we didn't make enough plays. They did. You know, obviously, we got to play better. We didn't play very well. They played well. They did some things where they ran the ball well. We ran the ball okay. They made a big catch there at the end. We couldn't get it done. So we got a lot to work on. You know, too many penalties without question. Obviously, we let them off the hook a couple times with a couple of defensive penalties. 17 penalties is disappointing. You know, obviously, that we got to get that straightened away and get it straightened away quickly.
We did it to ourselves out there. You know, mistakes, drops, penalties, you name it, we did it. It's on everybody, you know. Everybody had their hand in it. Receivers, running backs, tight ends, O-line, me. It wasn't good enough. You know, we'll work to correct it. It's all you can do. The guy made a good play. He was guarding Anquan on the outside, and obviously hindsight's 20/20. Wish I wouldn't have thrown it. He was guarding somebody else and came off and made a play.
That's the National Football League when you don't finish the game. We're not going to complain or anything about the calls or anything like that. I just think we got to play better. Start off, you know, like a house of fire in the first half, and then we wasn't able to maintain it and finish it that way. And that's what happens in the National Football League. You got to keep scoring. This is a young football team that show fight and grit a little bit. We just got to learn how to finish, and that's my job, and that's the staff's job to get them to do it. I'm disappointed as anybody for the guys, you know. They've worked extremely hard, and last week I thought they had a great week of practice, and I thought they were ready to play, and that showed. But, again, it's my responsibility to make sure in the second half we're ready to play, too. Can't just play one half. The guy battled his tail off. I know he played under a little duress, you know, from their defensive front. And also, you know, he was battling a little injury, but he fought as hard as he could.
It's disappointing, you know. I think it's, you know, who we are as a young team. It's things we got to learn, how to, you know, ride these waves back and forth and grab some of the momentum back and go put the ball in the end zone. I'll speak for myself on the part I did in kind of losing some momentum and just can't do that. My mindset is, you know, that everything will be all right and we'll move ahead, business as usual. So it's just a matter of letting the doctors and trainers do their job, and my expectation is to play some ball.
Play fake. Bear looks in the end zone in the corner.
I think the wide receiver questions have been answered for Ohio State, and the Sooners are shocked.
I think any time you go on a road, you kind of narrow down your travel to about 70 guys, and the 70 guys who got on the plane were on a mission. Defense was outstanding today. They've been outstanding all year. First thing our coaches tell you, they can play better, but they're very talented. We had a couple tough injuries, you know, when Garyon went down. That's a tough injury to overcome, but the guys went in and played hard.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
More than just an afternoon extravaganza on a Monday like the, following the weekend like the one we just had. This is a Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the extravaganza. What's going on? Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Phone lines open and going to keep them open all day, even though we have guests coming. We want reactions from Lions fans after that ridiculously crazy, wow, how did they give up the fourth down touchdown with a minute 13 left loss to Marcus Mariota and the Titans. Where if you are a Browns fan and you're wondering how in the hell are you leading 20-0 and end up losing 25-20 to the Baltimore Ravens, we'll take your calls. If you're an Ohio State Buckeye fan and you're wondering, holy crap, how in the hell did we go into Norman and pound the Sooners as badly as as badly as we did that? If you're a Wolverines fan and you want to call us and talk about how in the hell did we fall down by 14 points to the Colorado Buffaloes, were we watching another miracle from 1994 happening again? We can talk about that. If you're a Sparty fan and you want to know how in the hell did anybody think we were going to lose to an overrated Notre Dame team after pounding them the way that they did, we'll talk about that. And if you are a Fighting Irish fan and you want to talk about how in the hell did Michigan State just own us and end our season, 3 weeks into the college football season, then we can certainly talk about that. And oh, by the way, if you want to talk about what happened with the Toledo Rockets moving to 3-0 with a big win, a dominating win over Fresno State, or if you want to talk about the rough loss that Bowling Green suffered 2 in 3 weeks now to Middle Tennessee State, we can certainly talk about that. Jim Cushland, did I mention that today was going to be a Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza? That's a lot of football, is it not?
No, it absolutely is. Yeah, and while we're thinking of that, how about this?
Cushland, welcome back. By the way, you have the Jets.
Grab your helmet. You're going in. It's time to play Monday Afternoon Quarterback on 106.5 The Ticket.
Get the mood ready.
I thought there was some accidental audio being played there. I didn't know what the hell was going on until I stopped and listened to it. Oh, yeah, that's the Monday Afternoon Quarterback open bet.
Because why not? I had it ready.
Yeah, there you go. Why not? I don't know. Most of the time, I don't even think about it. I just start yelling. anyway, really, really crazy weekend of college and professional football, and we're going to cover it on as many different levels as we can. Coming up in about 20 minutes or so, 22 minutes, we're going to talk with Dennis Maniloff about the Browns' loss to the Ravens and about the Lions' loss to the Tennessee Titans. So a little NFL from that standpoint. We'll also, by the way, I know it's Monday Afternoon Quarterback, but we will also mix in a little bit of baseball as the Indians took a couple more giant steps toward the Central Division title in the American League by beating the Tigers 2 out of 3 times. And then Trevor Bauer took some monumental steps toward getting himself killed by some very angry Tigers yesterday by plunking 3 of them in the first 2 innings, which we'll get into. So Maniloff can talk about the baseball series over the weekend. And more importantly, you know, it was a winning weekend for the Indians over Detroit, 2 out of 3. But it was a losing weekend overall because they lose their number two starter, Carlos Carrasco, after previously having lost Danny Salazar. Both of them, 99.99999% sure, both are gone for the rest of the year. Carrasco, we know for sure. Salazar, there is, I don't know, a minuscule chance that he might be able to pitch sometime in the postseason if they were to last long enough.
And by the way, because all bad things like to come in threes, of course, very late last week, you find out that Yan Gomes, despite his issues at the plate, he was on rehab, gets plunked in the hand, so he's officially done. So even in the playoffs, your battery is now Roberto Perez, Chris Jimenez, period, end of story.
By the way, just to make sure that nobody underestimates the importance of that, and I really shouldn't do this right now, because I don't want to get into it. I want to really talk about football for all the reasons we just ran down. But I saw the statistics of the Indians' starting pitchers before Yan Gomes went down and after Yan Gomes went down. Cush, they are astounding. Forget about his bat. Forget about the fact that he's had one of the roughest seasons. In fact, no doubt he's had the roughest season that he's ever had since he's been in the big leagues. Clearly, but honest to God, the statistics of the way he handles a pitching staff, the way he works with and has the chemistry with and the symbiotic relationship with, whatever you want to call it, with the Indian starters, is simply staggering. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but I'm going to find it again because I read it on Saturday or something like that. And right after, because I think it was Friday you got plunked, wasn't it?
I think it was Thursday. Friday we were learning that, he's done.
Yeah, and when I give you the stats about what the pitchers have done with Yan Gomes behind the dish and without Yan Gomes behind the dish, you'll be simply amazed. So I'll share that with you a little bit later on as I go. I don't have the time right now at this moment. All right, to find it, basically, because I'm all talking about football now. So where do you want to start? Do we want to start talking about the Lions' loss, the tough loss to the Tennessee Titans, or do you want to talk about what I saw yesterday with the Indians or with the Browns? Jim, the Browns started like a house of fire. Now, I tweeted, like literally as they jogged onto the field for the kickoff, I tweeted, the Browns have just taken the field, and already I am in a profoundly depressed mood. it's their first home game, and you ought to be excited about that. You know, it's an exciting time, and I was automatically depressed just because I know what the next 60 minutes of football holds. A whole bunch of suckitude, right? So my son, of course, is watching the game with me, And the Browns come out and they take that opening drive and they march down the field and punch it in and just look like world beaters. And my son said, oh, yeah, the Browns suck, huh? And I said, yeah, well, be patient, son. It was a nice drive, but be patient.
And I didn't catch the stat for this one, by the way, the notation, but I think that's the first time in years, plural, that the Browns have started a game first drive and actually scored a touchdown. I don't know the number, but I know it's been seemingly forever since they've been able to actually do that.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. I'd love to see if there is a stat on that. Don't knock yourself out finding it, but it is very interesting because you're right. It's just it's rare. We know that for sure. So anyway, going on. They get the ball back, and did they get it back after? No, they forced a punt. They forced a punt, I believe, on the Ravens' first drive. So they get the ball back on their own 15. First play. There goes Isaiah Crowell through a cavernous hole in the left side of the line for an 85-yard touchdown. And they're up 14-0, and my son is all, well, really, Dad? Really? The Browns are going to suck, huh? You're in a bad mood, huh? And I said, Jerry, you don't understand. I understand they're hot right now. They made a couple of plays. I said, but guess what? This is the youngest roster in the National Football League. And I explained to him, Jim, what you and I and
right.
some of our guests talk about all the time, that this is a team that some in the NFL ranks have accused of trying to tank the season because they're so young and so talent depleted. They're trying to tank the season to get the number one pick overall next year.
Right.
And I said, so don't be fooled by this. And then what do? They get a Joe Hayden pick, and they score again with Corey Coleman. And he is just, you know, oh, yeah, he's in my face, and, you know, really, you don't know what you're talking about kind of thing. And I'm thinking, my God, who are these guys? What the heck is this all about, right? But then, of course, on the extra point kick, it's blocked, and the Ravens return it for a two-point safety.
Because for those who hadn't heard, yes, you can do that now in the NFL. That you didn't always used to be able to do that.
It's only the second time believed to be that it's ever been done in NFL history.
Because I think that rule took effect last year, if I'm not mistaken.
No. That's not right. Because the last time it happened was before last year.
Okay, all right.
It was definitely.
It was very recent. I know that.
Well, anyway, it was the second time in U.S. history. And so what that means essentially is, and I tweeted this too, the Browns had just scored a four-point touchdown. How in the hell do you score a four-point touchdown? That's what they did, because their lead went from 14 to 18.
Right.
Because they got six, but they gave two away on the extra.
Yep.
So it's a four-point touchdown. And at that moment in time, I looked at my son, and I said, the Browns are going to lose this game. Now, to that point in time, the Ravens had not done a thing on offense, and the Browns had not been stopped yet. Three drives, three scores, three touchdowns. But I said, the Browns are going to lose this game. Watch. Because I knew that prosperity couldn't last. And I knew as soon as they got cooled off and had to punt the first time, and the first time that the Ravens had a drive, it was going to start to settle in. The talent disparity was going to start to settle in. Sure enough, after that 20-0 lead, which quickly became 20-2, the Ravens scored the final 25 points of the football game. The Browns had a 20-0 lead in the first, never scored again, and the Ravens, of course, just methodically did what they do, which is, you know, run the ball, pass the ball, defend the ball, and play the game light years ahead of where the Cleveland Browns play. I said it at the time, and it was sad. I wasn't trying to prove a point to my son because I was pleasantly surprised. You know, I mean, obviously I said, you know, let's watch the Browns. And you know what I did is I actually turned it on. I turned it on and I said, I wish we had NFL tickets. We can go around and watch a whole bunch of different games because I don't want to watch this one for very long. And he's like, why? And I said, because they suck, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be just painful and disappointing. And so as I said, yeah, don't get excited after the first score. Don't get excited after the second score. And even don't get too excited after the third score. I was secretly very, very happy because it was just totally unexpected. And, you know, wow, look at this. Who are these guys? But once that blocked point happened, I said, there it is. That's the trigger. That's the trigger that turns things completely around and gives the Ravens what they need and the Browns what they didn't, and the Browns are going to lose this game. And sure enough, there it is.
Yeah, I kind of had a very similar thought. My thought process at the time of that block was, just watch. These things always happen. Those missed points like that come back to bite you.
Yeah, exactly right.
I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I didn't think it would be 25 unanswered after that because they were playing well. I tweeted it at one point, and thank goodness it looks like Josh McCown's coming back on the field. And by the way, how messed up is it when you're saying thank goodness for Josh McCown? And that was right all about at this same time, and I'm thinking, that block is going to come back to bite him somehow.
Yeah, and the block, you know, it's not like the 2 points were the deciding factor here. It was what it did to the momentum. It just sucked all of the balloon out of the air, out of the Browns' balloon, that they were just, you know, blowing up and boom, 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 and it just deflated, and I think it did in the stadium there yesterday too. So that's the way that all went down. And then, of course, to add insult to injury, Josh McCown goes down. 2 quarterbacks, 2 shoulders, 2 weeks. And now, all of a sudden, here's Cody. Cody Kessler is going to be the Browns starting quarterback next week. A kid who went...
Not just next week, probably. Like a while.
We will see. We will see. I don't know. We didn't get a report yet on how serious McCown is, right?
That is true. All that's been officially announced is Cody Kessler will start against the Dolphins on Sunday.
But what I can say is that they are describing the McCown injury as being serious.
Yep.
This is as of this morning. His left shoulder injury is believed to be serious, and the Browns are gearing up to start Cody Kessler, and obviously they're going to have to sign somebody. Where's Johnny Manziel when you need? Oh, wait a minute. Even if he was in game shape, even if he was in playing, you know, peak performance mode, even if he wanted to go, I mean, look at the Patriots are starting a rookie next week too because Jimmy Garoppolo is down. There's so many quarterback openings, but Johnny Manziel, even if he could convince everybody that he was ready to go, because this guy can't stop using drugs or drinking alcohol or whatever it is, he's got a 4-game suspension in front of him.
Yep.
So he's gone. So, I mean, not that I give a rat's, you know what, about Johnny Manziel anymore, but my point is, this is how bad it is. Griffin down, McCown down, Kessler up. Who's next? Austin Davis after that?
Actually,
is he still on the practice squad?
I got to double check that, but I can say this. Back on Friday, part of the montage, I threw in a Hugh Jackson clip because somebody asked him about the quarterback depth, and he said, and I see if I can bring this back up, but he said something to the effect of, oh, I already got the guy. He's stashed on the roster, so I kind of think the emergency quarterback is Terrell Pryor.
Well, yeah, they won't do that to him. There's no way they'll do that.
I don't think so. I hope they don't, but I loved what I've seen out of him in 2 games.
Jimmy spent the last calendar year plus learning how to be a receiver.
Exactly, and I've been impressed with what he's been able to do. So I hope they don't do that.
Not a star, but they're not gonna do that. There's no way. By the way, Austin Davis is with the Broncos now, so that's not happening. I'm trying to see who the practice squad is. Here it is. The only quarterback on the practice squad is somebody by the name of Kevin Hogan, a fellow rookie from Stanford. So there's nobody with any experience whatsoever that they can put under center against the Dolphins this coming week.
Ugh.
And now you add that to, of course, just real quick, one final footnote here in the monologue on the Browns game. For everybody who wants to blame the officials for the loss because of the ridiculous taunting call on Terrell Pryor after that 20-yard catch took them down to the 10, and they had 4 shots at it with about a minute to go, right? 4 chances.
Just about, yeah.
For everybody who, you know, and then of course they call the taunting penalty, which wipes out the 20-yard gain essentially. In fact, it offset. It offset.
Because there was a
defensive holding penalty, I think it was.
Yeah, defensive holding.
Well, anyway, look, was that a terrible, horrific, ridiculous call by the official? Did Terrell Pryor do something so egregious? No, he did not. Yes, it was a horrible call. I think he was trying to flip the ball to the referee.
He absolutely was.
Essentially just missed.
And the defender just happened to be right there, exactly. So it hit off him. And that's all the official saw, was a
terrible
ball hitting the opposing player.
Terrible call. But I'm going to say this to any Browns fan listening right now who is thinking that the referees, because I read this on Twitter, oh, the officials cost us a game. Listen to me. The officials did not give up 25 straight points. The officials did not stop scoring after 20 points in the first quarter on the first 3 drives. The Browns lost the game because the Browns are the Browns. It was a very Browns way to lose. They're a bad football team. That's how they lost the game. Did the official help? No. Did the official cost them the game, you know, himself? Absolutely not. The Browns simply, you know, took a game that they had complete control of and did what only the Browns can do, and that is give complete control away over the course of the next 3.5 grinding quarters.
Yep, it reminds me of an old Casey Stengel line when he managed the original expansion Mets. I'm just going to substitute the word Mets for the word Browns here, Bob. Come see my amazing Browns. I've been in this game 100 years, but I see new ways to lose I never knew existed before.
Beautiful line, and exactly right. Exactly right. Now, let's switch gears and get over to the Lions real quick. And then we'll take some phone calls, and we're going to talk NFL football with Maniloff and everything else. Jim Caldwell has decided that the Lions have some issues. They've allowed 30 fourth-quarter points in two games. 30 fourth-quarter points in two games. They cannot close games. They cannot finish. They know full well. Matthew Stafford said it after the game. We know we let a golden opportunity slip away from us, and we have got to find a way to get better. But I don't know what that way is going to be. This is a brutal loss. A minute 13 left. You get a, by the way, a gorgeous throw, an absolutely gorgeous throw from Marcus Mariota to Johnson in that play. But I'll tell you what, this is something that the Detroit Lions, they're gonna look back at this 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, 5 weeks from now, whatever their record is, and it's gonna have one more L on it than it should. And this is gonna be this is gonna be something that they remember. This is gonna be something that sticks with them, and it's gonna be something that, quite frankly, they're gonna live to regret. Caldwell said it's like there were two ball games. We're 1-1, not 1-15, so we have to look at it that way. But it's two ball games. One, of course, and they won in interesting fashion. Not that it was a dominating performance by any stretch of the imagination in the win over Indianapolis and Indianapolis, but they did finish that one despite the fact that the Colts had a tremendous fourth quarter. And now they lost this one again with a poor fourth quarter. It's two ball games. We're 1-1, not 1-15, but we've got issues. Let's not kid ourselves. That's a direct quote from Jim Caldwell. They've blown double-digit second-half leads in each of the first two games. Even though they rallied to beat Indianapolis, like we said, the Lions had three touchdowns called back by penalties.
That's of their 17 on the day.
What does that mean? What does that mean? That's a discipline thing, and I'm not going to just call Jim Caldwell out and say he coaches an undisciplined team, but somewhere, somehow, that's just unacceptable. I don't care if you're the Oakland Raiders, 17 penalties is a lot of penalties. You know, and they're just often, you know, referred to as the dirtiest team in the game, et cetera, et cetera. I don't care if you're the Raiders. They're looking at 17, man. That's a lot even for us. Three of them costing touchdowns.
Yep.
That is a lot even for us. Three touchdowns called back, 13 straight fourth quarter points given up, and to a team that tied for the worst record in the NFL last year, by the way, in the Titans here. This was a very, very winnable game. To go to 2-0 to start this season could have been huge for the Lions' confidence, for their momentum, for the fans to get jacked up. As they go into Green Bay, which, of course, has been a house of horrors there until they snapped that long losing streak last year at Lambeau. But they're going to Green Bay 2-0. It's a different Green Bay coming off of the loss in primetime last night. It could have been a really, really different kind of atmosphere. But because they can't finish games and they can't stop anybody in the fourth quarter, now the Lions are 1-1 and questioning themselves. And Jim Caldwell has questions to answer from the media and from others about his team's preparedness, his team's discipline, their ability to not turn the ball over, their ability not to commit penalties that cost them touchdowns, et cetera, et cetera. They lead the NFL with 26 flags through two games.
Oof.
And as I mentioned, the defense has allowed 30 fourth quarter points. So the Lions are in a really, really bad way. And they're really only a few plays away from being in a very good way.
Yep.
As we talk about, you know, with those penalties. But it kind of reminds me, Jim, you could almost repeat the Casey Stengel line for the Lions to talk about new ways to lose.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, the Browns do it more colorfully, let's put it that way. But I look at this game for the Lions, and you got the 17 penalties. You still had a chance late despite the defensive issues in second half and fourth quarters, and you get a Matthew Stafford interception. And then the side part of me wants to know, because it started in the late third, and it got him closer, but there's two fourth-quarter touchdowns, one in crunch time from a second-year quarterback who is still thought highly of in Mariota. I'm sitting here thinking, how much credit do you give to Mariota and what he was able to do, and how much is it really just the penalties and the bad fourth-quarter defense? I'm a little split on that right now.
A little bit of both. Mariota was 10 out of 12 in the fourth quarter with two touchdowns. 10 of 12!
There you go.
That's a guy, you know, a guy who's becoming seasoned very, very quickly. He's in his second year, and he's figuring it out. So you give him credit, absolutely. But again, this is not, it is Marcus Mariota year two. It's not Tom Brady. That wasn't Aaron Rodgers. That wasn't, you know, one of the, you know, the league MVP or something like that. It's Marcus Mariota with the Tennessee Titans team that, quite frankly, is not going to be a playoff team. And it's a team you cannot give up in the fourth quarter, that kind of that kind of passing number too, and that kind of an offensive performance too. By the way, the other part of this for the Lions that has got to have people worried is the injury factor. Four starters down is how they finished it. Obviously, DeAndre Levy did not dress, but then Ziggy Ansah sprains an ankle, Amir Abdullah gets a foot injury, and Kyle Van Noy, I should say, has a calf injury, the linebacker. So you get a bunch of injuries there as well, and just all in all, a pretty doggone bad day for the Lions and for, of course, the Cleveland Browns. All right, let me get a call in before we go to the bottom of the hour. Sports Center. Talk to Jimmy in Toledo. Hey, Jimmy, you are on the air. Go right ahead. How are you?
Hey, Bob, four bullets.
Bullet number one. Let's hear it.
All right. I know there's probably 10 people in the whole city that actually want to watch the University of Toledo Rockets, but I'd prefer to watch, be able to flip over to the SEC and see meaningful games. I don't – 30 minutes to low squeeze on the Browns when you can just sum it up, the Browns of the Browns. The Lions, this is why Calvin Johnson's on Dancing with the Stars, because he didn't want to participate in new ways to lose. And all of you Michigan fans out there, Colorado, if they could kick a field goal or execute a punt, they might have taken you the distance. And I don't think Colorado could score on the Buckeyes.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jimmy, thanks for the call, brother. Good points on all four of them. Yes, by the way, did you see the news? Speaking of watching the Rockets
yes.
play meaningful football, did you see the news today? UT has inked an agreement to visit Touchdown Jesus in the fall of 2021. So 5 years from now, the Rockets, Jason Candle's Rockets, assuming they're still Jason Candle's Rockets, will be at Notre Dame in South Bend in 2021. And that is a very, very cool thing to see. They have obviously, the Rockets have never played Notre Dame, but they played so many, you know, FCS or FBS schools. They've played Power Five conference teams all the time. You know, they've been to Michigan, they've been to Ohio State, they've been to SEC schools, and on down the line. But now, it's what, 2.5 hours to South Bend from Toledo?
Yes, as far as one would think.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a great opportunity there for the Rockets, and we'll talk about that in a bit as well. All right, let's get a quick timeout here. Ohio State, by the way, I agree with him. Colorado probably would not score on Ohio State. Ohio State looks scary good in September with a whole bunch of new starters. Wait until you see them in November when they actually have almost a regular season's experience under their belts. So we're going to talk about that coming up as well at about 4:05. We'll talk to Chris Lauterbach from 11warriors.com. All of that coming up. And Maniloff on the NFL next on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on our Wii on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. It is 3:40 time to talk NFL football with our good friend Dennis Maniloff of the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the Northeast Ohio Media Group, where the Cleveland Browns yesterday had their home opener, and it ended like so many other home games. At First Energy Field yesterday with heartbreak for the Browns. D-Man, what's going on, brother? How are you?
Bob France, always a pleasure.
Dennis, I love Monday because we get to look back at an unbelievable weekend of college and pro football, but it becomes so painful. And I know you don't live in Toledo, so you don't know what it's like out here, but we got just, you know, tons of Browns fans and tons even more Lions fans out here just looking for something to get excited about. And you talk about the way two games ended yesterday. It's a painful thing. How did the fans back there in Cleveland react to not only the loss, just the overall fact now that they're 0-2 and it's another home loss, et cetera, but the fact that they blew a 20-0 lead, and then, of course, they had a crucial call go against them on a ridiculous taunting penalty, finding new ways to lose in Cleveland.
Yeah, it was really a mixed bag of emotions. There were, you know, some that talked about the same old Browns, some that were, you know, focusing on Pryor and the bogus call, some focusing on McCown getting hurt, just like McGriffin had the week before. You know, it was just, a typical mess. And you know what, Bob, you can't even make this stuff up. You really can't. I mean, the Cleveland Browns are set to take a 21-0 lead. Your kicker basically kicks the ball into the line. I don't care what the Ravens say. It's blocked, and not only blocked, but returned for two. Okay, so if you're going to tell me that there's not a difference between 21-0 and 20-2, I'm telling you you're full of it, because that right there was the change of momentum that the Baltimore Ravens needed. It sounds ridiculous.
No, it doesn't.
But it was true.
No, it doesn't. It does not sound ridiculous at all, Dennis. You obviously aren't listening to us here in Toledo, but I spent the opening monologue talking about my own situation as I watched that game. I was watching it with my boy, and he was jacked up, three Browns touchdowns in a row, and I'm saying, relax, son, relax. They're hot right now, but this is a long game, and this is a bad team, and blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, the moment that kick was blocked and returned for the two-point safety, I said to him, the Browns will lose, period. Because of the momentum shift, but just because of the fact that also the Browns just scored the unthinkable, only the second time in NFL history that a team has scored a four-point touchdown. And that's what it is. When you score six but give away two on the very next play, that's a four-point touchdown.
Yep.
Your lead only went from 14 to 18 instead of 21 to nothing. So that to me signified, okay, that's the beginning of the end. And sure enough, Dennis, you know, the Browns never score again, and the Ravens, of course, go on to score 23 more.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, previous week, disastrous fake punt. So no matter what, a fake punt in which the punter wasn't even, you know, lined up in the backfield or lined up to take the fake. It's just, it's one thing after another. And then, obviously, even with the lead, it came with an asterisk because you saw McCown's left arm hanging, and you're thinking, all right, how long is he going to be able to make it? And he even had to go to the locker room in the first quarter, I would think, to get a shot to numb it because he wanted to continue to play, but I don't know that for sure. But, you know, he comes out in one of the guttier, grittier performances you're ever going to see. A one-armed guy going out there and playing, and the fact that he finished the game was incredible. But unfortunately, when you look at it clinically, if you take away the incredible toughness, you realize at the end of the first half, they got the ball and, you know, they're sitting on a lead, and McCown makes a really ill-advised throw that you can't use the arm as an excuse. He wouldn't use it as an excuse. It's intercepted by Weddle, and boom, 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 the Ravens kick a field goal to end the half. All right, there's at least a three-point swing, and that turns around and bites you at the end of the game. So everybody was to blame here. It wasn't just one guy, but it was another loss.
Yeah, no question about it. And so where are we? It's Cody Kessler, who, to be honest with you, when he had to start warming up there when McCown initially got hurt, I saw eyes the size of saucers. He looked like he was like, what? I got to go in. Sorry to say that. And I know there have been a lot of rookie quarterbacks that have been forced into action here. We know that Jimmy Garoppolo being down in New England now with that sprained AC joint is going to lead to a rookie starting there. We saw Cody Kessler, and we also know that Dak Prescott. I mean, there are rookies that are being forced into duty, and I quite frankly don't know if Cody Kessler is among those who are ready.
Well, Bob, I agree with you, but my question is why? Okay, why isn't Cody Kessler ready? I mean, why can't he be? This is what I don't get because, all right, he came from USC, a vaunted program. He played a lot of games in college. He's not hurt, to my knowledge. What's the problem? You know, it's almost like we've taken for granted over here, well, Cody Kessler's not ready. He's not ready. He's not ready. Well, why isn't he ready? You know,
I think one of the reasons is he is prepared to be what he was supposed to be, and that is the number three quarterback. A guy like Carson Wentz was competing to start. You know, a guy like what's the kid's name who's going to end up starting for New England? For goodness sakes, I lost his name already because now that Garoppolo is down. Yeah, I lost his name already.
Sorry.
He's another. He has been preparing because they knew Brady was out. He has been preparing as a backup and getting a backup's reps rather than a number three's reps. And obviously going down the line to all the first-year quarterbacks who are playing, Cody Kessler, you know, is being forced into a situation where he had third-team reps. He had, you know, inactive reps. This is a guy, you know, how many teams can you honestly see – Can you honestly think of, Dennis, that you've seen lose their starter and their backup in the first 2 weeks of the season back-to-back, where
well, Bob,
the third stringer is forced into duty?
Yeah, I hear you, except for the fact, here's where the root of my question comes from.
What?
In camp, we were hearing about how bad, you know, Kessler looked and how unprepared he was going to be, you know, if he had to play. And that was what was, I guess, alarming was, okay, why why does he have to look so bad, you know, in camp? Why can't he be sharp, at least, coming from where he did? So I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Well, you tell me, Dennis, because we all recall when he was drafted, there were a lot of raised eyebrows when they said, really? That's, you know, there were some more experienced, more polished, more highly rated quarterbacks on the board when the Browns announced the name of Cody Kessler, and people were wondering, you know, about the Browns, you know, is there a tie here with USC here? It's kind of a favor that maybe that Hugh and the guys are doing for USC by taking this kid, or whatever the reason was. But there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of questions about why they took this kid, because he's perhaps, you know, not nearly as highly rated as where he went in this draft, and we saw that maybe in the training camp and in the preseason, and sadly we might be about to see it against Miami.
Yeah, and look, I'm not bailing on Hugh Jackson at all. He's got a long road ahead of him. I believe in the guy. I think he's gonna make it happen at some point. It probably will take a long time, as we know, but I do wonder, though, you know, what prompted Jackson to say, trust me on this one? You would think that when he said, trust me on this one, he was buying into a guy that he believed he could get ready to go relatively quickly. And you would think that he would have known already, perhaps, that there was a cerebral element to Kessler, that he could pick up the game quickly. That's what's puzzling to me. I mean, if Jackson was so convinced that Kessler was the guy, why can't his ETA be soon, as opposed to, well, you don't want to play this guy for a couple of years? That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Dennis Manteloff is our guest. We're breaking down the Browns.
By the way, Bob, what's wrong with the Lions? Are you kidding me? Let me go off on the Lions.
That was my next question anyway, so be my guest. Go right off on the Lions.
This is unbelievable. And the reason I'm upset is because I do picks for the Cleveland.com and the Plain Dealer. I do picks against the spread. All right, so last week, entertainment purposes only, last week, first week, I think I took the Colts at home, right, against the Lions.
Right.
Lions put up, what, 39 points? 39-35. The they moved the ball like the Colts weren't even there. So I say, you know what, week two, I'm going to buy into the Detroit Lions. They're at home. They're playing the Titans, who, you know, I admittedly the Titans are not that bad, but they're not. They're a team the Lions got to beat. So I buy in, and what do the Lions do? They lay an egg on me at Ford Field. What a joke. Come on, Lions.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, you're 100% right. They really did. That is a very beatable team. Jim Kushtel and I were talking about that before you came on, too. That is a very beatable team. You give credit to Marcus Mariota for going 10 out of 12 in the fourth quarter with two touchdowns to lead that comeback win. But you have to say, what is wrong with the defense that has given up now in 2 weeks 30 fourth quarter points? Even in beating Indianapolis in the game you just mentioned, they gave up a ton of points in the fourth quarter. 16 and 14 now in 2 weeks. This is a team that can't stop anybody with the game on the line. One, you know, they won one of them and they lost one of them, but for goodness sakes, there's something wrong with the Lions defense. In the second half of games, they got issues. They got issues up there at Ford Field, no doubt about it.
Look, I get frustrated with the Lions whenever I pick them and they lose. That's my issues with them. That's where my issues come from. But I can't imagine being a Lions fan, just like Lions fan could come back and say, well, what about you guys in Cleveland? You're right. I mean, you look at the two
of the sorriest franchises in the National Football League, quite frankly.
It is amazing. When you hear about parity all the time, parity in the NFL. Any team can beat any team. Okay. But where was the parity? Who didn't drop the parity on Detroit and Cleveland? When did that ever happen? I mean, it's unbelievable how bad those two teams have been for years.
Dennis, what about going back to the Browns game for just a second, and I want to ask you a couple more NFL questions. The taunting call on Terrell Pryor.
It was ridiculous, just horrible. I sound like a homer, okay, because I'm from Cleveland, okay, fine. But look, any objective view of that play or that post-play says that there was no taunting whatsoever. Pryor had just made a really good catch at the 10-yard line with less than a minute to go. His team's trying to score a TD. I believe it was Webb, was on the ground. And Pryor, you could tell, is trying to pitch the ball to the official, and it kind of squirts out of his glove and just harmlessly falls on Webb's shoulder pad. There's no other way to look at that. Pryor never even looks at Webb. He never even, does anything that would indicate taunting. And this overzealous linesman comes flying in, not even the official that Pryor was trying to get the ball to.
Right.
The guy comes in from behind.
Right.
And, you know, he's throwing the flag. It was just absurd. It was over-officiating at its worst, and it was an incredibly important point of the game, and it cost the Browns dearly. I mean, they've got first and 10 at the 10, or first and goal at the 10, with enough time to get three shots at the end zone, maybe even four, and instead, you're back, you have offsetting penalties, you don't get the gain from the pass, and you wind up throwing a pick on the next play. Just horrendous officiating.
One more from the AFC North. The big, brutal, physical battle between the Steelers and the Bengals, a rematch of the playoff game, of course, without Vontaze Burfict because of what he did in that playoff game. Really an ugly kind of a game. It's some terrible weather, torrential downpour out there in Pittsburgh. But the Steelers are 2-0. Are they the best team in the AFC?
You're not going to get an argument from me, Bob France. That team looks nasty. I mean, they really do. They're so loaded offensively, and I mean, they don't even have all their weapons yet. So I can't even imagine what that team would look like, devoid of suspensions and being 100% healthy. So yes, I'm not going to dispute it. I watched a lot of the Broncos Colts game, and I know the Broncos are defending Super Bowl champs, so they deserve the benefit of the doubt. But if I had to see those two teams play each other on a neutral field, for example, I think the Steelers would win the game.
Yeah, I think you might be right. And obviously it's very, very early, but the Broncos defense is ridiculous. Super Bowl MVP Von Miller is picking it up and making a case in the first couple of weeks that, hey, you better start considering me for league MVP. And we know that doesn't happen. And we know that J.J. Watt, if it's ever going to happen, it's going to be a guy who's won three out of the last four Defensive Player of the Year awards like Watt. But Von Miller, I don't know how much you got a chance to watch, strip sacks, setting up touchdowns. I mean, he really is a guy that offensive coordinators have to game plan around, maybe unlike a lot of guys we have seen in this league on the defensive side for quite some time.
Absolutely. I saw the strip sack, and then they ran it in. Somebody else scored. But Miller's tremendous. He barely played, in the camp. So good for them, good for the Broncos. Yeah, they have a really good defense. Trevor Siemian, Northwestern, a solid player. We'll see if he develops on offense. But, I just think as good as the Broncos defense is, and obviously they took a hit with Ware, and we'll see what happens with him with that injury he had yesterday. But if I had to put the Steelers offense against the Broncos defense, I like the Steelers' chances of moving the ball and scoring, because for a variety of reasons, of course, starting with Roethlisberger and Brown.
Yeah, no question about it. And how about D'Angelo Williams? That guy is just he's ageless. He's ageless,
yeah.
And he's going back to the bench after one more week when the best running back maybe in the league. By the way, Adrian Peterson, who generally has that title of best running back in the league, has some torn meniscus. We've come to find out in the last hour. Adrian Peterson suffered torn meniscus in his right knee. Mike Zimmer says the timetable for his return is uncertain. Not ruling out that he can play this week, but there are several options there. So Le'Veon Bell is who I was talking about there. Dennis, last thing. I only have about a minute and a half before we got a jet. But since you're out there in Cleveland, and we just saw two out of three go to the Tribe over the Tigers as they reduced their magic number to 7 now to win the division championship. That's a great thing. But obviously, the rotation now looks like Corey Kluber, Trevor Bauer, who can't stop hitting guys, and then what? Josh Tomlin, Mike Clevinger. If that's the playoff rotation, the long, hard-fought division championship they're about to salt away could end in a very, very short October appearance.
Scotch tape and paper clips are needed here, Bob France. It is going to be difficult. First of all, they got to get in the playoffs. All right, first, that's number one. I mean, I know they have a large lead, but they still have to play Detroit four times in Comerica. Now, anything can happen. So the first thing they got to do is figure out a way to get into the playoffs. And once they get there, if they do, it is going to be difficult. There's no denying it. I mean, really, you have Kluber and everybody else, because I don't think Trevor Bauer can be trusted coming off of the September, or in the midst of the September that he's having, where his ERA is north of 7 in four starts. So it is going to be very difficult, especially when, you know, you don't have an unlimited supply of relievers because of roster expansion, and you have to have a finite number in the playoffs. But it'll require every ounce of creativity that Francona can summon. But to this point, obviously you never complain if you're the Cleveland Indians that you've been able to lead the division by 7 games in mid to late September.
Briefly, Dennis, is he the manager of the year, Terry Francona? Without
Without
Brantley all year, without Gomes for most of the year, without Salazar for much of the year, without Carrasco for two different parts of the year, who else? Who else am I missing? They've without Almonte because of the PED thing, but still, without him, I mean, there's been so many injuries that team has endured this year. To be about on the verge with a magic number of 7, assaulting away the division championship, I don't really know. No disrespect to anybody. You know, Texas is going to win their division, Boston. But, I mean, honestly, I don't know anybody else who's had to do more with less, given the injury situation, than Tito Francona.
Yeah, absolutely. It should be a runaway. If the Indians lock down the division, to me, there's no debate. Francona is the manager of the year. What he's done is nothing short of remarkable through 149 games.
There you go. Good stuff. Dennis Manilow, thanks so much for your time. As always, brother, we appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
We'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks very much. Here's Dennis Manilow talking football with us, and then just a little smidgen of baseball. You know what else that reminds me of? That reminds me of the Buckeye Store and More. A whole lot of football and a little smidgen of baseball. That's the Buckeye Store and More in Sylvania, the college and pro superstore. You see, the entire store is dedicated to Buckeye gear, but also with huge fan zones for the other football teams that you'll love, whether you're a Michigan fan or Notre Dame or Michigan State or Toledo or BG, and a little smidgen of baseball. They've even got a Tigers fan zone in there as well. How about that? That's the Buckeye Store and More. And right now, 10% store-wide savings ongoing here into the season. 10% on every single item in the store. And if you get there early, you can get select items for 50 to 75% doorbuster items each and every day at the Buckeye Store and More in Sylvania. 5700 Monroe, they got hundreds of new Nike products in stock, and they got hundreds more products arriving each and every day. The largest store in Ohio dedicated to Buckeye gear and more. That's the Buckeye Store and More in Sylvania. 5700 Monroe in Sylvania and Starlight Plaza. The Buckeye Store and More is the College and Pro Superstore. Hour number two coming right up, and we will be talking Buckeyes with our good friend Chris Lauder back from 11warriors.com coming up next on The Ticket.
This is the way the league is. It's just going to be tight games that are tough. It just depends on, you know, the team that makes plays at the end. And obviously, we didn't make enough plays. They did. You know, obviously, we got to play better. We didn't play very well. They played well. They did some things well. They ran the ball well. We ran the ball okay. They made a big catch there at the end. We couldn't get it done. So we got a lot to work on. You know, too many penalties without question. Obviously, we let them off the hook a couple times with a couple of defensive penalties. 17 penalties is disappointing. You know, obviously, that we got to get that straightened away and get it straightened away quickly.
We did it to ourselves out there. You know, mistakes, drops, penalties, you name it, we did it. It's on everybody, you know. Everybody had their hand in it. Receivers, running backs, tight ends, O-line, me. It wasn't good enough. You know, we'll work to correct it. It's all you can do. The guy made a good play. He was guarding Anquan on the outside, and obviously hindsight's 20/20. Wish I wouldn't have thrown it. He was guarding somebody else and came off and made a play.
That's the National Football League when you don't finish the game. We're not going to complain or anything about the calls or anything like that. I just think we got to play better. Start off, you know, like a house of fire in the first half, and then we wasn't able to maintain it and finish it that way. And that's what happens in the National Football League. You got to keep scoring. This is a young football team that show fight and grit a little bit. We just got to learn how to finish, and that's my job, and that's the staff's job to get them to do it. I'm disappointed as anybody for the guys, you know. They've worked extremely hard, and last week I thought they had a great week of practice, and and I thought they were ready to play, and that showed. But, again, it's my responsibility to make sure in the second half we're ready to play, too. Can't just play one half. The guy battled his tail off. I know he played under a little duress, you know, from their defensive front. And also, you know, he was battling a little injury, but he fought as hard as he could.
It's disappointing, you know, and I think it's, you know, who we are as a young team. It's things we got to learn, how to, you know, ride these waves back and forth and grab some of the momentum back and go put the ball in the end zone. I'll speak for myself on the part I did in kind of losing some momentum and just can't do that. My mindset is, you know, that everything will be all right and we'll move ahead, business as usual. So it's just a matter of letting the doctors and trainers do their job, and my expectation is to play some ball.
Layfield, Barrett looks in the end zone, in the corner! I think the wide receiver questions have been answered for Ohio State, and the Sooners are shocked.
I think any time you go on the road, you kind of narrow down your travel to about 70 guys, and the 70 guys who got on the plane were on a mission. Defense was outstanding today. They've been outstanding all year. First thing our coach will tell you, they can play better, but they're very talented. We had a couple tough injuries, you know, when Garyon went down. That's a tough injury to overcome, but the guys went there and played hard.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It is 4:12. Hour number two is underway. We go from the NFL to the college ranks, and how about those Ohio State Buckeyes? You heard from Urban Meyer there. I got to tell you, I didn't see it coming. We did our picks on Friday. I felt like Ohio State was probably the better team. Going into Norman, because of what I saw from Oklahoma in the first game against Houston, I felt like Ohio State was probably better, but I didn't think they were light years better. And given the fact that I felt like they were only a little better, my view was that Oklahoma's sense of urgency and playing at home in Norman would be enough to counteract the slight talent disparity. I picked Oklahoma because if they lose, their season's done. And essentially, their season is done. Even though, inexplicably, they're still in the top 25. How do you hold on at number 24 or 25 even when you are 1-2? And you didn't just lose two close games. You got beat pretty good by Houston, and you got beat up by Ohio State at home in your building in Norman. That just cannot be. But I did not see this beatdown coming in the way that it did. I did not see Noah Brown, who had 5 catches in his Ohio State career, going for 4 touchdown catches in a single game. I did not see the defense frustrating Baker Mayfield as much as they did and pushing him into mistakes. It was just an all-around epic performance by the Buckeyes. And joining us now to break it down, college football style, Chris Lauterbach, who writes for 11warriors.com, an Ohio State Buckeyes site. Chris, how are you this afternoon?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you on the program. I enjoyed our last conversation so much, we decided we'd like to do it again, so I'm glad you were amenable to that. Did you see, even in the best-case circumstances, even as a Buckeye supporter, going in there and beating Oklahoma by 21, by 3 touchdowns?
No, I didn't. Much like you, I definitely felt there was a talent disparity there. I think if you really dig in, and we had one of our guys dig into it, and there really is a talent disparity there when you talk about the amount of blue chips and recruiting rankings over the course of the last handful of years. Mm-hmm. I think Ohio State's roster stacks up more than favorably against Oklahoma, but for the reasons you stated, Oklahoma being desperate, Ohio State could have lost this game, and as long as they didn't get blown out, still be in the college football playoff hunt. The game's the first true road game for a bunch of kids that have never played in a road game for Ohio State. So, yeah, there were a lot of reasons there that made me think. I had Ohio State in a close win. I did not have a blowout, at all as being something I foresaw, but it was fun to watch.
Is Noah Brown that good? Is this the guy that JT Barrett is now his go-to guy, or did Ohio State just see something in the corners for Oklahoma, because all 4 touchdowns were in the same place, almost identical routes with the exception of one being a bit deeper than the others, but did they just see something they could exploit there in that individual matchup, or is that something that we can see, you know, a steady diet of going throughout this season?
Well, I don't know that we'll see 4 touchdown catches a game, you know, for a steady diet for anyone, or he'll just be in the Hall of Fame before we know it. But I do think, you know, everybody knows Noah Brown's story after he broke his leg
last year in camp, but everybody had already kind of pegged him as being, you know, one of the best receivers on the team, and that's when Michael Thomas was still here. So,
I just heard something give out. I think we may have lost the phone line there, Jim. Yeah, we'll try to reestablish that connection with Chris Lauterbach. And, of course, my question about Noah Brown is he going to do that every week? Of course, that's not possible. But, I mean, is this a go-to guy? Is this a guy that, you know, you can expect to be the number one receiver on this team, the, you know, the biggest playmaker in the passing game that J.T. Barrett looks to? Or is this just kind of a, you know, not necessarily a one-week thing, but a, hey, in a given situation, wow, look what we can do? Because we're talking about a guy who, like I said, who has 5 career catches coming into this one. And suddenly he has 4 catches for touchdowns in one game. So it's really a question of whether or not that is something that J.T. Barrett can look to on a routine basis, a regular basis, say, when I need to make a play, that's the guy I can go to. Certainly not talking about 4 touchdowns a game or even a touchdown a game. That'd be nice to say you can get one every week, give him somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 or 13 or 14 in a season and be All-American. But, you know, can this guy become the number one threat in the passing game for J.T. Barrett? That's kind of where we're looking at that. And we'll try to reestablish this connection with Chris and get him back on the line and talk about that. Also, something else we'll talk about with Chris Lauterbach when he gets back. The young label, something that Ohio State has been bristling at, really, you know, since the season started, and everybody's preseason predictions were affected by, if not predicated upon, how quickly Ohio State can mature because they're so very young. And that is something that I think is a very fair, you know, analysis, to be quite honest with you, a fair analysis of Ohio State coming into this whole thing. We do have him back. All right, let's see if we can get Chris back up and on the line. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that. Not sure what happened.
No, I'm not sure either, but it's cellular technology. We never know what happens. That's all right. I want to talk about the youth of Ohio State and whether or not that is still an applicable term. But before I do, let's get back to your thoughts on Noah Brown and whether or not he can be, you know, that number one type receiver where J.T. Barrett, he knows if he needs to make a play, that's the guy he's looking to. Or if this is more of a, you know, lightning in a bottle for 1 week, whether or not he can kind of, you know, keep being that guy for J.T.
Yeah, I see him being the top wide receiver for sure. Again, putting up the numbers he did Saturday probably aren't realistic. I think a lot is going to depend, quite frankly, on who else steps up at the wide receiver position. As I was attempting to say before we drop there, is that I was surprised that Stoops, that defensively Oklahoma never really made any adjustments. I mean, he was never really doubled or anything like that, even though just physically he had a mismatch over a couple of the different guys that were guarding him and no adjustments were made. I think, you know, going forward, you could see more of that, where defenses do try to, make a little bit more consideration for handling Noah Brown, considering the rest of the wide receiver core has done nothing. I mean, even in the Oklahoma game, you know, Paris Campbell had a catch, Terry McLaurin had a catch, James Clark had a couple, but it was for, what, like less than 10 yards total. We have not shown, other than the H-backs with Curtis Samuel and Dontre Wilson, that any other receiver is going to do anything. And until that happens, I think it's going to be easier for teams to try to take Noah Brown away if they want to.
We are talking with Chris Lauterbach of 11warriors.com, an outstanding Ohio State Buckeyes website. I want to talk about youth now, because this is something that more than one Buckeye player had to say after the game against Oklahoma, that they're tired of being talked about in terms of how young they are. They're tired of saying, well, maybe you're not ready because you're so young. Sam Hubbard, defensive end, the sophomore, said, I hope it is that this was a graduation by beating Oklahoma and Norman because we're tired of hearing how young we are. Mike Weber, redshirt freshman, said, I feel like that talk is over now, too. First of all, is that a driving force? Is it okay if it's ticking these guys off that people think they're too young to be good right now? And do you think that is going to be the end of that talk now that we saw how dominant they started this season?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be the end of that talk from a, you know, expert analysis type situation. But you never know. I mean, Urban Meyer likes to use his psychology degree. And I'm sure that, you know, he is probably more responsible than anyone with, you know, filling this team with thoughts of, hey, people think you're too young to be good. People don't think you can, you know, prove this or that. This is a team, when you look at the roster, that is made up for the type of coach that Urban Meyer is. And, you know, we look at hindsight at the national championship team a couple years ago. It had a similar makeup, right? A lot of unproven guys at key positions that were talented. And those seem to be the types of teams that he can get the most out of. So I'm sure he's leveraging this youth talk and, you know, using it as something that people are, you know, discounting the team about. So I would imagine it's going to linger in the locker room a little bit, but nationally, yeah, I think that might be the into the Young talk for a while.
After going into Norman and just stomping on the Sooners the way that they did, and then watching Alabama struggle a bit, fell behind big early against Ole Miss, and then took command, and then had to hang on late against Ole Miss, looking more vulnerable, at least, you know, this particular week than Ohio State has in any of their 3 weeks, including on the road at Norman. Does Ohio State deserve to be number one right now?
I think you could certainly make a case. I mean, you know, to me, Louisville has looked like one of the best teams in the country. Ohio State has looked like one of the best teams in the country. Sometimes we just fall victim to what the preseason polls, you know, start with, and then we make our judgments from there when we really don't know who the best teams are until they play a few games. But, yeah, when you look at the body of work and just look at, you know, how they buried bad teams and then buried, you know, what we think is probably a pretty decent Oklahoma team, I think you could certainly make the case. You know, still a long way to go, but I think they're going to be a favorite to be in the playoff, you know, as this conversation continues to evolve. Alabama's interesting. You know, they're replacing some guys too, and college football, I mean, NFL is the same, but if you don't have a quarterback, you know, that's what you need. Florida State just got exposed a little bit with an unproven guy. Alabama's struggling, you know, a little bit, to really solidify their quarterback position. And, you know, meanwhile, Ohio State has JT Barrett, who, if healthy, we know what he can do. And in college, if you've got a difference maker at quarterback, you're a threat to be in the playoff.
Speaking of different makers at quarterback, and you mentioned Louisville, who jumped all the way from 10th to 3rd after that 63-20 demolition of formerly number 2 Florida State. Is that, you know, when it was 63-10, I thought I heard the announcer in that game say that it would be the worst loss ever by a number 2 team, ever, anywhere in the history of college football or since the rankings. I don't know if 63-20 still held that or not. But regardless of whether it was a record or not, it was an unbelievable statement by Louisville. And Lamar Jackson, is he, I mean, a lot of people are saying that this is his Heisman Trophy now. Deshaun Watson may have started the season as the odds-on favorite. He is no longer. JT Barrett might still have something to say about that as the Big Ten season goes on, but Lamar Jackson has pretty much made himself the front runner by a wide, wide margin.
Yeah, he looked amazing. I've really not seen them play in, you know, the totality of all their games, but I've seen good chunks, and I watched all of the Florida State game, and yeah, he just ate their lunch. You know, he's not a super polished passer just yet, but what he can do with his feet is just ridiculous. And if he continues to evolve as a passer, then I would say, yeah, he'll have as good a chance as anybody to win the Heisman. But I think we have to be careful. I mean, hell, Michigan quarterbacks have won the September Heisman, you know, a handful of times in the last few years, only to do nothing when it really started to matter. So I don't get too spun up on that stuff just yet. You know, Barrett could certainly continue to, you know, polish his resume as the season moves along as well.
Michigan, of course, was the trendy, you know, preseason pick to be a real mover and a shaker and a player in the national championship hunt, if not the champion of the Big Ten, but certainly a factor there. Jim Harbaugh won the offseason, no question about it. Did you start to see a little bit of chinks in the armor, if you will? They were down 14 at one point to Colorado before taking over and winning by 17.
Yeah, I watched a lot of that game. I think for them, is some of the same problems they had last year. Spates is actually playing, you know, playing all right, but I'm just still not sold on their offensive line. At the end of the day, when it starts getting a little bit colder out and you're playing games in conference, you're going to have to be able to run the football. And I've not seen enough from them yet to make me think that they're going to be able to run the football against good teams. And if they can't and they become truly one-dimensional, despite having a very solid receiving core, that's going to catch up to them at some point. A bad weather game in October or November could be, you know, very detrimental to their hopes. And, you know, Colorado's not a bad team, but they've been beating up on some, you know, really bad teams before that. So I think the jury is still largely out. But, yeah, I'm not convinced. I'm not on the Michigan bandwagon just yet.
Did Notre Dame just play two really good teams to lose two out of the first three, or were they just flat out overrated? They got beat by Texas in that epic double overtime game, and now Michigan State took it to them pretty good on Saturday. Were they just overrated from the start?
Yeah, I think they are. I think they're kind of like Oklahoma. You put their name behind them at the beginning of the year and who their coach is and that type of thing, and they're always going to be probably ranked a little bit higher than they should. And then when you start off the season, you know, with two legit opponents like that, you know, it just went south on them in a hurry. But yeah, to me, they're a middle of the pack, fringe, you know, top 20-ish type team. And personally, I just think that's their reality these days.
Yeah, I think that might be the case, you know, and it's a surprising thing to see, to be honest with you, because I know Notre Dame gets rankings because of that name, like you said, in much the same way Oklahoma and maybe even Michigan and others do. But I really thought they had a little bit more than this in the early going. They're one of the big surprises. Last thing, Oklahoma gets blown out as they did. And again, they lost pretty badly to Houston, too, pretty comfortably anyway. How are they still in the top 25? In other words, let me re-ask the question. Should we be ranking teams at all? I know I asked you if the Buckeyes should be number one. But Jim and I, Jim Cushlin, who of course is our producer and you talk to, we talk about this on a relatively frequent basis, that we think the real first ranking should not come out until the first Monday in October. After we've seen the first weekend of football in October, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, whatever they're playing, then we'll rank them again, rank them for the first time on the first Monday of October. Then we'll know what teams really have. Is that too far-fetched, or do you like this early season ranking stuff?
I don't really love or hate the early rankings. They are what they are. They give people something to talk about. You know, when you talk about the AP or the coaches poll, you know, pushing those back, I think, is fine. But truly, I think we do have a poll that comes out when it starts to matter, and that's the College Football Playoff Committee's poll. And, you know, that doesn't come out until basically midway through the season. So I think, to me, we're already there with the poll that matters. It's just these ones we have now. Again, it's really just more for, you know, us and ESPN talking heads on TV and whatnot to talk about. And it makes it fun to kick the stuff around. But, yeah, I think the poll that already matters, that only matters, already has the right idea with, you know, letting half the season bake out before we start making some decisions.
Where's the first real threat? Well, I'll let you run after this one. And we're talking to Chris Lauterbach of 11warriors.com, an Ohio State devoted website. Where's the first threat on this schedule for the Buckeyes? Obviously, they have Rutgers this week. That is not a threat. Indiana's not a threat. They're at Wisconsin and at Penn State back-to-back in the middle of October, then hosting Northwestern Nebraska. Is the first threat, could it really be just the last 2 weeks of the season when they got Michigan State and Michigan back-to-back, or can Wisconsin give them a rumble?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to call that the first threat. I don't know if it's the most threatening out of what's left, but I do think you know, going into Camp Randall is never a cupcake. That's a night game. It's on the road again. It comes after, you know, a much-needed bye week this week. But then you're going to have two games where it's really kind of hard to get up for. In the Rutgers game on the first, that's a noon kick, you know, against a not a very good team. I would not be surprised in the least if Ohio State comes out a little bit flat that game, comes back the next week for Indiana. You know, those are both home. Even though they're just kind of games you have to trudge through, they're obviously not going to lose, but then now you've got to get revved back up to go into this night game at Wisconsin. I think they'll win that game, but I would have to say that's the next threat. But then after that, yeah, I'm not really, you know, at Penn State has been tough in past years, even when Penn State is nowhere near on the same level as Ohio State, but I just don't see them, you know, really, really, truly being challenged until they got to go to East Lansing on the 19th of November.
Yeah, and then that back-to-back, they do get Michigan at home, of course, the week after that. Last thing, I know I said it before, but just since you brought up Penn State, everybody in college football or who covers college football the way you do, and the way we do, has an opinion on what they did in Happy Valley on Saturday. They commemorated Joe Paterno and his, I don't know if it was his anniversary of his first win or whatever it was, but they found a reason to celebrate and commemorate the coaching career of Joe Paterno. It was a very controversial thing. Diehard Nittany Lions loved it and said absolutely, and they just kind of thumbed their nose at the critics, who, of course, hold Joe Paterno partly responsible for those decades of abuse of children from Jerry Sandusky, and, of course, others wanted this thing stopped in its tracks. What do you think? Should they be honoring and you know, commemorating the legacy of one of the winningest coaches of all time, but somebody who retired and eventually died in some form of disgrace?
No, they shouldn't have at all. It was embarrassing. It was disgusting. It's really just despicable that they would choose to do that in my eyes. It's funny. I mean, they're out in the middle of nowhere, and it's almost a cult that, you know, follows and stands up for Joe Paterno. I really don't know what else to say about it without this needing to be on HBO, because I think it's ridiculous that they chose to do that at all. And I liked how some of the Temple fans turned their back on it and face the other way in the stadium as it went down.
Yeah, I did too, and I thought it was pretty telling that the pregame ceremony that they had there, they put up curtains on fences to basically block media so that nobody could watch it and then taunt them so they can kind of do, well, like you said, you know, maybe have their little cult meeting or whatever in private before they did the ceremony in the stadium before, you know, before all of the fans. But it's just a... It's just a weird thing because, to me, if you're going to defend him and say, look, nothing was ever proven in court or anywhere else that Joe Paterno did anything wrong, that he reported what he saw when he or what he was told anyway, when he was told something to his superiors.
On 106.5 The Ticket.
All right, it is 4:47, so that means 13 minutes away from drive time with Mike Miller right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, Toledo sports leader. Phone lines are open to you now at 866-240-1065. Get in on either the NFL or on the college football scene from Saturday. And, Jim, I got to throw this in there, too. I don't want to sit here and play I told you so, and I'm not saying it's all because Jim Harbaugh is the Michigan coach, but I've been saying for the last couple of years on this radio program that the Big Ten needed to get big again for really, you know, Ohio State to get the recognition that it deserves. For example, they need to become, you know, the elite conference in college football rather than be viewed as the weaker, one of the weaker of the Power Five conferences. You know, the SEC gets all the love. Alabama, Ole Miss, LSU, Auburn, they're all, you know, considered to be better than the schools up in the North and in the Midwest. And that part of that is because I think of the SEC bias fostered and advanced by our partners at ESPN and ESPN Radio, to be honest with you. But I said Michigan needs to become a player again, with Wisconsin and Michigan State rising up in recent years to being truly national powers, joining Ohio State. All they really need is for Michigan to rebound and become Michigan again, to really have the conference earn that respect. Penn State, of course, getting back to, and it's hard though, you know, it's really difficult to quantify the difficulty level, if you will, for them to overcome everything that they had to overcome coming off of probation after the Paterno, the Sandusky things and everything else. It's hard. And then, of course, they had Bill O'Brien, and he did a great job of getting them rebounded during the probationary period, but then he left and went to the Texans and they had to start again, and it's hard. But when Penn State is a power again, I mean, we're talking about maybe the most powerful of the Power Five conferences. Now, I bring all of that up to say that this weekend, the Big Ten made a massive statement in that regard. Take Ohio State, dominating a Power Five and top 15 team on the road in Norman, beating Oklahoma by 21. Take Michigan State, another impressive road win on the road at South Bend over Notre Dame. Now, Notre Dame might not be what they used to be or what people thought they would be, but it's in part because of what Michigan State just did to them, again, in their place. Add to that Nebraska upending ranked Oregon. Add to that Michigan over Colorado, Northwestern over Duke. And the Big Ten went 5-0 against Power Five opponents this weekend. That raises, Jim, through 3 weeks, their season record against other Power Five opponents to 8-3. Compare that to the SEC, the glory conference that they are. The ACC, with Florida State previously overranked at number 2, by the way, heading the way, and Clemson also previously overranked at number 2, I believe, especially the way they looked in the first couple of weeks. In the Pac-12, they are 5-5. The SEC is 5-5. The ACC is 5-5. The Pac-12 is 5-5 against Power Five conferences. The Big 12, 3-6. So the Big Ten right now, arguably, is the strongest, most well-balanced, and I don't know about well-balanced, but top-heavy, certainly, conference in the country compared to the other Power Five schools. They are Power Five conferences, 8-3 versus 5-5 and 3-6, Kush.
Yeah, and honestly, the only blemish for the entire Big Ten was, of course, Iowa losing to North Dakota State, which is the one 1AA school that's not really as much of a shame to lose to anymore. I'm still waiting for somebody to say, come on up to the big boy level, but that remains to be seen. In terms of the structure, it's not just the numbers you just rattled off there. I think we're into a place now where it is SEC and Big Ten And then the other power conferences, and it's not just the records, it's the things going on, you know, in those conferences. The Pac-12 has been a little bit weaker, especially considering USC's not all that great. And then you just mentioned Oregon getting taken out. That's really two of the top three, usually, the other one being Stanford.
Yeah, I was going to say Stanford is still legit to me.
Right, right. So there's that. The Big 12, I mean, you know, goodness, it is what it is. And especially if Oklahoma's struggling, that's going to be a weight around everybody else in the Big 10 or Big 12, whether they deserve it or not. Kind of in the same principle of how the Big 10 in recent years wasn't viewed as good because one of the traditional powers, Michigan, wasn't as good, right? And the ACC, the ACC is the ACC. About the best thing they have going for them is the fact that it seems like the best quarterbacks are in that conference this year, but otherwise they're still not overall that strong, especially if Florida State's going to go down the way they did. Then that conference smells like Louisville, Clemson, and everybody else after that. So I think we're in a position right now where, depending on your biases, it is SEC, Big Ten, and then the other Power Five schools.
Yeah, and well, you're still going SEC first? After everything that I just read you, as far as the you know, where they are this season. Let me throw another one at you just for the sake of it, since I rattled off those numbers and they didn't impress you enough to say Big Ten right now maybe is the best conference in the country today at this point. Maybe not for all time, but for now. Here's another one. The Big Ten is a national best 24-6. That's an 800 winning percentage, 24-6 versus all FBS opponents. The SEC is 17-7. They're second best at a 7-06 winning clip. So when you take the record against other Power 5 schools, and then the other Power 5 conferences against the Big 10, and then, of course, against all FBS opponents, the Big 10 is quite frankly dominating right now. Now, again, I'm not saying they're all going to end this way. I'm not saying the Big 10 is going to end with six teams in the top 15 the way the SEC has done, in part, once again, and I hate to continue to use excuses, but, you know, there may be something to this, and it's not just a straight excuse. But there is that SEC bias among voters in the media. There is an extraordinary amount of respect for teams like LSU, for example, that quite frankly don't really deserve it. And you could say the same thing about some of the other schools down there. Ole Miss has been overrated at times. Auburn, you know, you can go up and down. Georgia is expected to be a major player, and then they end up wet in the bed. So you look at if you look at the way things are right now, it might not be how it will be in November when they select the teams for the college football playoff and when they select the New Year's Day Six Bowls and all the rest. But for now, anyway, I don't think you have to say SEC and then the Big Ten. I think it's fair for now, again, to say Big Ten and then SEC. And then let's let that ride. You know how you said if you're number one, you have to lose to get knocked down? To me, you know, I go ahead and say Big Ten is the number one conference, and they got to lose that in order to get knocked down.
If anything, I guess part of my viewing is right now, because the SEC has been in that position, whether it's all bias or not, they've been in that position for these last bunch of years. To me, the clincher, for me anyway, would be end of this season. If Big Ten keeps doing what they have been doing right now, and then you get into the bowl games, because just so happens that there's a lot of Big Ten v SEC matchups. And if the Big Ten takes care of business basically on New Year's Day, then I'll be willing to switch them. Otherwise, right now, I'm going to put them in kind of a tie.
The best team in the SEC is Alabama. The best team in the Big Ten is Ohio State. Okay. Put them on a neutral site right now, based on what you just saw for 3 weeks. Who wins? Neutral site, Nick Saban, Urban Meyer, Alabama, Ohio State. Neutral site, who wins?
I'd have to say Ohio State right now.
I would, too. I absolutely would. And I'll tell you what, I think, I don't know if there's anybody in the SEC that I would say, if we all consider, say, Michigan State, or Michigan. Michigan is ranked higher.
Yeah.
But if one of those two teams is the second-best team in the Big Ten, let's say they are, pick the next two best in the SEC, I'm not granting the SEC wins there.
Yeah.
So I just think it's important. And by the way, Urban Meyer, just to kind of talk about what he has done, he's 53-4. In four seasons now. I mean, remember, he coached in the SEC at Florida for so long. He's 53-4 in the Big Ten, the undisputed face of the Big Ten's best team, and he does not blink in the face of the SEC. And so, or at the sight of Nick Saban or anything else. So to me, yeah, you know, you look at what Ohio State has done, the way Michigan has come back under Jim Harbaugh, look at Michigan State's continuing evolution and Wisconsin's recent in the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years growth into a national power as well. I don't think you can find 4 or 5 SEC teams that you can say are clearly, legitimately that much better. All right, that's it for now. I apologize if we ran out of time here for calls or anything else, but thanks for being part of the show. Mike Miller is coming up next with Drive Time right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, great conversations all day. Let's pick it up where we left off tomorrow at 3 right here on The Ticket. Have a good one.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances. And get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.